Shrink Wrap Radio number 642, America's Identity Crisis, with Jungian analyst Michael Gellert.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, and we are going to be discussing his recently revised book, America's Identity Crisis, The Death and Rebirth of America's Vision. Last year, about the same time, we discussed his book, The Divine Mind, on episode number 587. For more information about Michael Gellert, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. The sponsor for today's interview is BetterHelp.com, offering responsible and professional online therapy. Now, here's the interview. Michael Gellert, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm really excited to have this opportunity to speak with you about your work and your recently revised book, which has been retitled America's Identity Crisis, The Death and Rebirth of the American Vision. And the original title, way back in 2001, was The Fate of America, An Inquiry into National Character. So now the original 2001 version received positive attention from two major political figures. Tell us about that. That was pretty exciting.
Well, I don't know how much ongoing attention it received. I was fortunate to receive a very nice letter of gratitude from Bill Clinton. He read the book. And I learned that Zbigniew Brzezinski, the late secretary of the NSA under Carter, passed the book on to Obama and his writing team during the campaign in the 2008 election.
Well, those are both big deals, I have to say.
It was a good news.
Yeah, good
and
news.
I heard that Kucinich, who was Dennis Kucinich, who was, I think, a House of in the House of Representatives, his writing team came into the bookstore at the Jung Institute in Los Angeles and bought something like 8 or 9 copies. So it was read by a few people in the political world.
I'm surprised to hear that anybody in the political world goes to the Jung store to buy Jungian books. Yeah, really. So what motivated you to write the second edition? Was it that you that it somehow became a little outdated, or was it more that you had more that you wanted to say?
Well, I was invited by Reputation, the publisher's Reputation, to reissue it. They were very interested in presenting something to the public about what we've been going through the last 2 years. And they kept encouraging me. And finally, I sat down and I decided to do it. I wrote a new foreword and added an appendix on the about the Trump years since his election. And the effect of this on an America, and what does it signify on our parts that we have elected him and that we find ourselves in this very polarized situation today. So it was an updating in that regard.
Yeah. Well, it's a very ambitious thing to take on such a sweeping topic as America's vision and national character. Do you feel that your Jungian training provided you or provides you with a kind of a unique perspective to take on such a daunting task?
Very much. The basic theme of the book, although it's in a language everybody can understand, it goes back to some basic Jungian archetypes. It looks at the psychic forces at work in the American character. And those are largely framed in a way that's compatible with Jungian psychology. As I mentioned, I changed the language a little bit so it's more accessible to everyone. But it's basically an analysis of the American collective unconscious.
Well, this is the kind of, well, good. It's also the kind of book that you would expect to come maybe from a political historian, and maybe you're partly that or have had to become partly that in addition to being a young analyst.
Well, I had to become partly that, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That was actually one of the most interesting aspects of the research was my chance to read all these fascinating books by authors from a wide range of backgrounds, but actually mostly from political science and philosophy.
Yeah, fascinating. Well,
philosophy,
as I mentioned,
the Enlightenment.
As I mentioned before, the scope of your book is so large that there's no way that we could, you know, cover the whole thing. And I kind of wrestled with, oh, what are we going to do in this conversation? And one of the things that you do in there is you identify some polarities, which is a very Jungian thing to do. And so I thought we could touch on some of those polarities. And then I was particularly taken with your final chapter on Trump, where you talk about the Trump paradox. So that's kind of my plan. Can we go along those lines?
Sure.
Okay, great. So how would you describe our national character?
Well, the national character is rooted both in the history of the Puritans in America and the Founding Fathers, of course. And the main source I go to is the Founders, because that is the main one our nation is today visibly rooted in. The character of the American Republic, as the Founders established it, was to create an enlightened citizenry. It's a term that Jefferson used. A citizenship where people are very conscious about creating a society that champions the, as Jefferson also called it, the brotherhood of man, and a kind of moral consciousness where we're reflecting on ourselves and what's good for society. Now, the two of the polarities in the book are what I call the spirits of youth and authority. That's a kind of a Hegelian term. The spirit of authority, you see this mostly in old nation states and civilizations. It's the spirit of wisdom. It's the accumulated experience of a nation or a civilization having been around a long time and learned how to survive. Because as the historian Toynbee has shown, there have been about 34, 35 civilizations that he himself recorded or wrote about in recorded history. And of those 34 and or 35, only four or so are still extant today. Only four are still intact civilizations. And Toynbee was very interested in what is it that makes the difference between civilization that survives and all the others that basically go extinct.
Yeah.
The founders were really trying to answer that question. The spirit of authority forms one of the backbones of the American character, and the founders champion that. The other side is the fact that we cannot get around it. We're not an ancient nation. We're a young right. nation. And we have this spirit of youth. So the young spirit is usually what seizes a nation in its early centuries. And that impulse is observable in the expansionism of certain nation states that have been under the influence of this psychic spirit, the spirit of youth. You see that in the Napoleonic Empire, for example. You saw it in World War II with Nazi Germany. This is a young, robust nation, America, but it also has its history of expansionism. We saw that not only in the conquest of the frontier and the rise of slavery to feed a plantation economy. We saw it in the wars that America has gone through. We're a country just over two centuries old, and we haven't yet had a single decade without either a war declared or undeclared. This is the kind of robust energy that gets channeled not only into things like industrial development and the expansion into the West, but you find it in its political history, too, in the form of wanting to rule the world or have an empire. The American empire is different. The sense of empire is different than in traditional empires.
Is that coming from the authority side or the youth side of this polarity that you're talking about?
Yeah, that comes mostly from the youth side.
Okay. I want to back you up just a little bit to national character. Because the thing that I picked up in the book was you referred to something called the heroic ideal.
Yes.
And it's not really separate from what you're saying, but maybe what do you – it really says it so well, but do you want to expand on the heroic ideal a little bit?
Yes, that's the second set of opposites that riddle the American psyche. The first, again, being the spirits of youth and authority, which are in a polar – relationship with each other, yet complement each other. And you find this also in the American heroic ideal. Now, the heroic ideal really is the identity inherent in the character that shapes the character. And as Jung said when he visited America, the archetypal disposition, the temperamental shaping factor of the American character is its heroic ideal. And what he described in 1930 is as true today as it was then, which is that America, unique among the nations of the world to the extent that it exercises this ideal, it is most shaped by that. And that is the ideal of greatness.
Yeah, yeah. I think of all these Hollywood movies, you know, that they've always portrayed us as, for the most part, until recently, we've gotten a bit tarnished and cynical, I think. But for a long time, there's so many like war movies and cowboy movies, and they're always about heroic conquering, taking on challenges, youthful kind of energy.
Yes, and actually what I try to show in the book is the evolution of America's heroic ideal, the evolution of its understanding of what is heroic and what is greatness. Today what we see is a kind of identity crisis around the meaning of what is greatness. We hear it talked about a lot in the media. Make America great again. What does that mean? Does that mean culturally great? Does it mean morally great? Does it mean militarily great? Economically great? We see it means all of these things. But the connection to the founding vision of what is greatness is something we've gotten out of touch with. And that's where the confusion of an identity crisis comes in. Mm-hmm. Because we've lost touch with the past. And as is well known, when we forget our history, we end up reliving it or end up in a quandary as to what's next. So that's the situation we're in. The particular polarity, the second one I discuss in the book, that riddles the heroic ideal is the distinction that I made in the appendix to the book, the update, which is the difference between an enemy-oriented heroism and a citizen-oriented heroism. Mm. And I'll say a word about that just so answer your questions. Yeah. The enemy-oriented ideal is a heroism that needs an enemy in order to define itself and to define its quest for greatness. We see that beginning with the American Revolution itself. Of course, the British Empire became the enemy of the revolutionaries. But we also find it internally and domestically, David. To have a slave, a nation that had half of it was in favor and practicing slavery, we see it in, again, all these wars we've had, even the conquest of the frontier, it was a kind of man against the wilderness. It was an enemy-oriented, conquest-driven heroism.
Yes.
Now, this is has its place in history. A nation needs a good connection with that, especially in a war that like what we had in World War II or when 9/11 happened. The country went straight to an enemy-oriented heroic ideal to face the crisis. The other heroic ideal is the one that the founders mostly championed, which is this citizen-oriented heroism. And that is the heroism that advocates the idea that what makes America great is its level of civilization, its culture, mm-hmm. its dignity, its intellectual and other artistic traditions. It's defined by the relationship of citizens to each other. And the idea of what makes greatness is not what the nation will do for us, as Kennedy said, but what we will do for the nation. So it's oriented toward social harmony and a greater consciousness of how to define the nation going forward. And that's where we're in an identity crisis today, because we still tend to respond to the crises of history in a purely enemy-oriented way. And there needs to be a citizen-oriented response as well, and sometimes primarily.
Let me break in here for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp.com, an online therapy site. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? You know, I'm reluctant to promote anything I haven't had some experience of myself. They've given me a free 3-month subscription so that I could kick the tires, so to speak. I haven't met with my therapist yet, but I can tell you I'm quite impressed by the sign-up and screening process, which involves completing several pages of questions so that they can narrow down a general idea of my issues and assign appropriate therapist. Some of the questions clearly were designed to assess whether I might be depressed or anxious and to what degree, if at all. I was also impressed that I had a choice of the type of therapist I want: male therapist, female therapist, gay therapist, Christian therapist, and so on. I chose male, older, spiritual, though not religious. They also provide photos and descriptions of all of their therapists and also client reviews. All are credentialed and have met licensing standards. Now, I'll be doing a series of ads for them, and I'll update you on my impressions as we go along. Let me tell you that BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log in to your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. Visit betterhelp.com/shrink and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. For Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/shrink. Once again, that's betterhelp.com/shrink. Now let's get back to the interview. Okay. There's another dynamic that you talk about that's also really important, I think, which is American innocence. And so talk to us about American innocence. I feel like it resonates in a way that I can understand, but yeah. Tell us about your take on it.
Well, innocence to most people means purity or moral correctness, being good, being clean and clear in one's behaviors. I mean it here more in the psychological sense of not being grounded in the world with its heart, school of hard knocks, with the darkness of life, the difficulties in being moral, because we humans, we all have feet of clay, and there's no nation state in the history of the world that has been without a moral blemish of one kind or another. The innocence is not in real a real tangible purity. It's in the belief, often erroneous or exaggerated, a belief that we are innocent or pure. And it's that self-conception and that self-righteousness that then informs our social behaviors, as well as international behaviors. We think we have a right to tell nations how it's going to be, to compel them to become democracies before they're ready, and not on their own initiative, but on ours. For a nation that's so grounded in its own image of itself as innocent, we've had a very dark history.
That's, to me, the word innocence also connotes naivete. And we go into situations politically, globally, showing incredible naivete. For example, going back to the Vietnam conflict, not understanding anything about, you know, great holes. There's about all of our conflicts. It seems like if you look back, we discover how much we did not know. That we come in arrogantly, starting to tell people what to do, what they need to do.
That's right.
A history of massive blunders.
That's right. And at its worst, it leads to, you know, phenomena like the genocide or almost genocide of the Native Americans, the enslavement of hundreds of thousands of Africans. It's a real tendency that belongs to the heroic ideal in its youthful aspect. Yeah. A young nation is innocent. A wiser nation that's older, that's been around for centuries or millennia, knows about this sort of thing. And if they've survived this long, they've learned that it has to be by cooperation and collaboration, not by conquest and dominion over other peoples and other nations.
Yeah, I think Europeans have often kind of looked at us with askance, if you will, because we are like naive children in some ways. You know, they've been around longer, they've seen a lot of the foibles of civilization and so on, and here come the bumbling, loud Americans, or the ugly American, as characterized by Graham Greene.
Yes, yes, that's right. Now, of course, Europe had its days of youthful expansionism, and even as recently as World War II. Germany, though, it needs to be understood, was a nation that was actually and still is young compared to the French and the British, who've been an organized nation state much longer than Germany. Germany, up until I think the 1800s, was still a kind of a tribal. The Germanic peoples were tribal, and they were living in the Rhine Valley. And only did that get consolidated relatively recently. So now that, you know, Europe is even including Germany, hopefully, have been around for a while, you know, they have a different model, a different kind of heroic ideal that's more mature. And of course, this whole thing about the EU, you know, the EU and Brexit, they're really a force. It's really a dilemma between similar heroic ideals is what we're struggling with. But we still here in America have quite a ways to go before we get a handle on this innocence. It goes away and we think it's gone. And then it comes back.
Yeah. It sort of relates to me to the Jungian idea of the shadow and a kind of unawareness and unwillingness to, you know, to work with our own shadow, to see it, to be aware of it.
Well, you're right. And American innocence is its shadow, is the nation's shadow. You know, it's what is known as a white shadow. Here, it's not only, not primarily white because Caucasian, but it's that too. Yeah. White simply means that the person who has a white shadow is the last to know that they have human flaws like ambition beyond what's good for oneself and others, or envy or hatred, xenophobia. All the things we see happening today have been in our American psyche and in the human psyche since the beginning of civilization. It comes with the human condition. As Jung said, the problem is not in the shadow. It's in the belief that we don't have one. Once we know we have one and we own it and we work with it, then there becomes a dual consciousness. There's the inherent impulse in the shadow to do its thing and get away with it. But there's this other side, what Freud called the superego, that is seeing it and evaluating it and standing up against it, making it conscious and integrating it consciously into one's awareness. That's the crisis we're in today in America. The last few presidencies has been an alternation going a back and forth between an old heroic ideal and one that strives for more of this civic consciousness. It's a peripatetic, disorganized drive between what's familiar and comfortable and the challenges of the unknown that are not so comfortable. So we could see from presidency to presidency, we flip between extremes. And that's because our character is divided in this way, and we're not integrating the two sides, whether the two sides are a higher conscious moral awareness and the shadow, or the citizen-oriented and enemy-oriented heroism, or the spirits of youth and authority. When these are not integrated, then the nation gets very divided, and we become our own worst enemies.
Okay. Well, let's start talking a bit about Trump, because that's certainly very contemporary and very fascinating. And in some ways, I think he embodies the kind of innocence that you're talking about. Would you say that's
true? Yes, he does. He has a very innocent and idealized view of America with very little recognition of its dark history. And for that part, of himself, of his own shadow.
Right. Like he thinks that he can make the deal, that he's such a good deal maker, that he'll make the deal with the Koreans, he'll make the deal with, you know, in Venezuela, etc. Go ahead.
I was just going to say what happens when these opposites, which need to be integrated, get so polarized that they split off from each other. What happens is that the worst side of both poles gets activated. So when youth is running amok, and as in the case of these last couple of years, and is completely dissociated from any sense of moral authority, the worst side of authority also gets constellated. So you get this dictatorial, authoritarian, behavior that you kind of see with sometimes with old people who don't have the patience anymore or the awareness. They're losing memory. Memory is a vital feature of the spirit of authority. I think it was Emerson who talked about the party of memory and the party of hope. Well, memory is the party of authority and of conservatism and republicanism. And hope is the territory of the spirit of youth, or the childlike aspect of the character. When these get too split apart, the worst of both are constellated. And what America's identity crisis, what I try to show there is the history of that and how that plays out. So today we're actually having an extreme polarization, perhaps more extreme than anything since the Civil War. And you see the worst sides of both aspects of our character constellated and at war with each other through us.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the conservative. What about the liberal side? What are the extremes of, you know, of that polarity on the liberal side that we see today?
Well, as a lot of commentators, liberal but seasoned commentators point out, is that everything can have its extreme. So, you know, conservatism actually is a necessary and good part of the American society and history. We've always been, from the very beginning, as Jefferson pointed out, a nation with two sides, a conservative and a liberal. The problem is that the value of conservatism, for example, conservation of the environment, or all those kinds of things which allow a nation to settle down and become confident by nurturing what works by the familiar and not always innovating so quickly that we're living in a, as we do today, in a very rushed society, then we make a lot of mistakes because we lose our perspective. When we're not grounded in a healthy conservatism, the worst side of conservatism comes up. And it's the same thing with liberalism. So a number of commentators point out how the very liberals on the very, very far left are not that different than folks on the very, very far right. Taken to an extreme, for example, you get people burning abortion clinics who are both extremely liberal and extremely conservative at the same time. You sometimes hard to tell them apart. So that's what happens when our dual nature gets split apart. The worst aspects of both sides get triggered, and we're at a loss as to what to do.
Yeah. I loved your comment that you said about Trump, that it's not necessary to come up with a diagnosis, as many mental health people have been wont to do. All you have to do is notice that he's basically a child.
Yeah, he has the, as many people have written about, including his ghostwriter who wrote his, at least one of his books.
The Art of the Deal, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He seems to be developmentally arrested at a young age. He had a traumatic childhood. I talk a little bit about that in that chapter, and of course, so does that author, that ghostwriter. You know, when your leadership is grounded in a childish outlook, it's going to have a huge effect on the entire nation. It's like a trickle-down process from the leadership on top. It triggers all the aspects in the culture that always were there. You know, these people who went on that march in Charlottesville, It's not that they were suddenly created by Trump. Everybody knows that. They've been elements in our human nature and in American society also from the beginning, going back to the early days of slavery and the Ku Klux Klan. What has happened is that the election of Trump has permitted an environment where these sides can come up and expose themselves more fully.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see.
It's a manifestation of the split between extremes and the loss of connection to our original heroic ideal, you know, a vision of a society that has a refined level of citizenry and collaboration between citizens. That spirit is seems to be taken have taken a back seat the last 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. Except for the people who write about it and try to call us to that, to remind us and bring us back, and there have been good examples of that.
Yeah, well, that's one of the good things that has come out of this period is that social activism and investigative journalism have come back. You know, it can be argued that, and a lot of journalists have admitted to this, that they gave Trump a free pass throughout the campaign of the last election and never believed he'd be elected. And now that he has, they're working twice as hard to make up for that and to be very conscious and make available to the public everything that's going on behind closed doors because our democracy is at stake.
Yeah. I want to read a quote from your book. There are a number of quotes that I pulled out, and I think it helps, it encapsulates what you've been talking about. You write, "Trump seems incapable of recognizing that democracy is a collaborative effort, not only with others in government and with the press, but with all Americans. Nor is he able to grasp how his misanthropic antipathy and divisiveness, the latter a weapon of the dark side of both youth and authority, have had the effect of a match striking a fire nationwide, creating civil strife, if not a civil war." So that's, you know, when you had the time and space to get it just right, that's how you articulated a lot of what you've just been talking about.
Yeah, that sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You also, you note on page 483, the same page as the last one, the Trump phenomenon is ultimately not about Trump, it's about us. And, you know, that's also a very Jungian point of view, which is to own the projection. It's so easy to get into, oh, Trump is such a bad guy, you know, and all these things. But we, somewhere in ourselves, we have to recognize at least some of those Trumpian qualities in ourselves.
Yes. Well, we created the system that allowed him to come into power, and a good portion of our nation voted for him. If we don't take stock of the fact that there are a lot of people in America who have genuine grievances, you know, globalization and the changes in the American economy have genuinely disenfranchised and marginalized tens of thousands of people. The folks in the Rust Belt who originally who voted twice for Obama and then apparently were the same numbers who tipped the election in favor of Trump, if we stay disconnected in the cities where we're not marginalized and where the economy has been to the benefit of citizens, if we stay unconnected to those people who live in the Rust Belt and elsewhere, then this sort of thing is going to happen because they have a legitimate complaint and we need to not be in an innocent white shadow about it. Mm-hmm. America has always been a country where people were struggling, and not everybody were the haves who were invited to the table. The country has always had a portion of its population living in poverty, and these folks rose up and said, we don't want to be have-nots going forward. So the positive, one of the positive aspects of this election was, I think it made Americans much more aware that we all need to move ahead together and make sure that we move ahead together. Because if we don't, and we leave a large portion of the population behind, we're going to become split in that way.
Yeah.
You know, the discussion on a moral consciousness and the psychological dimension of this, it's not divorced from the economic dimension. Heroism needs to include both. You know, it's no accident, David, that the words inflation and depression are words that mean the exact same things, both in psychology and in economics. So yeah. We need to integrate these things and have a consciousness that generates policies that work in both contexts, the American psyche or culture and the American economy.
Yeah, yeah. I want to read another long passage here. You say, and this is on page 486, if anybody out there gets the book, which I encourage you to do, and wants to look it up.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we can only just sort of dip our toe into the wonderfulness of this book, I think, because it's so thoughtful. You've really studied far and wide to marshal your arguments, and it's just a very sophisticated book, and yet not beyond anybody's ability to read it and understand it. I mean, you've laid out complex dynamics, but in a way that's very clear. So I really congratulate you on that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and so here's an example. You write, a more advanced paradigm of heroic idealism would move beyond the frontiersman, soldier, conqueror, who defines success purely in terms of what he has won. It would be beyond the heroic idealism of commercialism and wealth without limitation, beyond the heroic idealism of flying higher and higher, whether through motion and speed, celebrity worship or sex, drugs and gambling, and beyond the heroic idealism that gives rise to the cults of novelty, freedom, happiness, and childhood. This would be an ideal that sees the hero as a healer rather than a warrior, a partner rather than a dominator, a collaborator rather than a competitor, a communicator rather than a... I wasn't sure if I read that phrase yet or not. A communicator rather than a conqueror, and an explorer rather than an exploiter. This hero would be strong but empathic and able to extend not only an iron fist but an open helping hand. He would be resolute but, if at all possible, nonviolent. He would be related not only to the traditional masculine virtues, but his emotions and the feminine as well. He would know how to live with his aggressive instincts and drives while also knowing how to be tender and nurturing. So that really sums up so much of the book. Is there more that you'd like to say? I'm going to leave it a little bit more open-ended right now.
Well, you just cited the page number 485. I think that's sometimes I wonder if I said too much. for a young country, America and its history are extremely complex. And what we see today is a kind of simple heroism, but because the character is complex, it is never a simple heroism with simple effects. When we deny our complexity and stop wrestling with it, it comes out in an unconscious, simplistic way. And we don't recognize the problems for the complexity they have. So that just adds a little more on to the quality I think everybody is feeling now, which is we're confused. We're befuddled. We don't know how to go forward and what forward even means. And again, that is because we're out of touch with our original founding.
Well, that's a good place to wind it up. I think that's a very solid statement. And so, again, I do really recommend this book to all of you listeners and viewers out there. Well worth your time. And I think implicit in it, there is a sense of a path and a sense of a way to go. So, Michael Geller, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
I'm not sure how much I can say about Michael Geller and his fine book beyond what was said in the podcast. The book, again, is America's Identity Crisis, The Death and Rebirth of America's Vision. In the podcast itself, you heard me congratulate him and extol the virtues of the book. As you can guess from our conversation, I found his analysis to be both sophisticated and compelling. He's put an incredible amount of work into making this book both authoritative and at the same time very readable. There are references and notes aplenty, which will guide further reading if you wish to dig deeper. You might think that with his being a Jungian analyst, that the book would be top-heavy with a lot of abstruse Jungian theory. You would be wrong. Actually, I'm not sure he says anything about being a Jungian analyst in the body of the book. I have the impression that you'd have to read the bio statement at the end of the book to get that. The book excels in giving the reader a template for understanding the confusing forces that are reshaping not only this country, but our world. If you haven't already heard enough about Trump and from Trump, I particularly recommend his chapter in the appendix, which is titled The Trump Paradox. In it, he writes about Trump's character and what he refers to as the Trump phenomenon. He starts off the Trump chapter with a verse from Leonard Cohen. It's coming from the sorrow on the street, the holy places where the races meet. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. Democracy is coming to the USA. I love that verse. I'm a big fan of Leonard Cohen, and that one seems particularly powerful, as so much of his music does. And I should also mention that Dr. Geller notes the irony that Leonard Cohen died on the day before Trump was elected. He also starts that chapter off with a quote from John F. Kennedy, and I quote, "This country is moving, and it must not stop. It cannot stop. For this is a time for courage and a time for challenge. Neither conformity nor complacency will do." And that's from an undelivered speech given in Austin, Texas, on November 22, 1963, the day before Kennedy was assassinated. As Dr. Gellert gets into discussing Trump's character, he quotes Vice President Joe Biden, who responded to then-President-elect Trump's tweets, saying, "Grow up, Donald. Grow up. Time to be an adult. You're president." You might expect that Dr. Geller would engage in a lot of Trump bashing. Actually, he sticks to the facts about Trump and underscores that Trump, in many ways, is our own creation, speaking to the hopes and fears of a significant portion of our fellow citizens, which many in the other half of us have chosen to ignore. In closing, let me say more about Michael Geller's background, which provides a good context for this fine book that he's authored. As I've already mentioned, Michael Geller is a Jungian analyst, practicing in Los Angeles and Pasadena, California. He was formerly director of training at the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles and a humanities professor at Vanier College, Montreal. He managed an employee assistance program for the city of New York and has been a mental health consultant for the University of Southern California and Time magazine. He has lived in Japan, where he trained with a Zen master. In addition to the book we've been discussing today, he's also the author of Modern Mysticism, The Way of the Small, and The Divine Mind. His website is www.michaelgellert.com.
This is your conscience calling. This is your conscience calling. It's time to give. Time to give to Dr. Dave and his wonderful, wonderful, intriguing psychological podcast network. Please give. You'll feel much, much better for it. Just click on the donate button and give what you can to Shrink Wrap Radio. You know you'll feel better. You know it makes sense. So let's all keep the network alive.
Thank you, Phil Schneider, for that rather hypnotic and creative encouragement for other listeners to support Shrink Wrap Radio. And it just so happens, I'm happy to report that we do have some first-time donors. Big thanks go out to John Bolton, Chris Marvel, and recent guest Ricky Greenwald, who spoke to us recently about the cutting edge of trauma therapy. And speaking of thanks, I'd like to read a delightful letter from a listener that I received just recently. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been catching up on some of the Shrink Wrap Radio episodes and wanted to reach out to you about episode number 626 with Professor Brett Carr. What a fantastic episode. I am now eager to read his book. This episode was very timely as I recently transitioned into a new counseling role. Like some of the therapists Carr spoke about, I too have multiple roles. I'm an adjunct instructor for SUNY Oswego's graduate counseling program, the president of the American Counseling Association of New York, and I spent the last 10 years in college counseling as a counselor, supervisor, and counseling center director. This year, I left my job as a college counseling center director and opened a private practice. Even though I had worked at a private practice in the past, it wasn't mine. So I'm now learning how to run a business. Flourishing in this practice is a goal, and I cannot wait to dive into Carr's book for inspiration. Thank you for the wealth of inspiration and wisdom that you gift so many of us through the podcast." And that's signed Sarah, and it's from Sarah F. Spiegelhoff, Ph.D., LMHC, NCC, Counseling and Wellness. And Sarah, I thank you so much for this letter of gratitude, and certainly it's very encouraging to me. And as you probably know, Dr. Carr is one of my all-time favorite guests, and you can't do any better than to follow his example and instructions on how to flourish in your private practice. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, Jungian analyst Michael Gellert, for discussing his book on America's Identity Crisis, The Death and Rebirth of the American Vision. Next week, I'll be speaking with neuroscientist Dr. Graham Moffitt of ChooseMuse.com, speaking about the development of their Muse 2 heart rate variability training device. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrink Wrapped by Dr. Dave, all the psychology you need to know. And just enough to make you dangerous.